Friends, this is Pablo with Wild Sons, and once again, welcome to the Wild Sons podcast. Today on the podcast, I have a special guest who has been a close friend and a mentor of mine for over 10 years now. He is Alan Arnold, executive producer of content at Wild at Heart, and author of several books, including The Story of With, Waves of Creativity, The Eden Option, Chaos Can't, and his latest book, which is at the center of today's conversation, is Risk the Real: How to Defy the Rise of the Artificial. During our conversation, Alan shares very important parts of his story and his journey from being a hard-driven man, focused mainly on accomplishments and the emptiness that he found in that life, to learning to walk daily with God as his true son. And then we dive into the contents of his latest book, Risk the Real, and we explore important questions like what is real and what is artificial, and what is our true north, and how the answer to those questions guides our daily choices, and how it defines the type of life that we end up experiencing. Alan's book and our conversation here on the podcast today are a bold invitation to pursue the real, to defy the artificial, and to risk well for what matters most. I hope you enjoy it. Alan, welcome to the Wild Sons podcast. I'm super happy that you're here with me this morning. This is a joy.
It's a blast to be here with you this morning, Pablo. And I can't wait for where God's going to take this conversation.
I know. Just before hitting record, Jesus was just taking me to this moment 10 years ago when you and I met. I was up in the mountains of Colorado, this beautiful retreat, this holy space, 32 men in a pretty rundown branch, but chasing after the heart of God. And it was one of the most spectacular weekends of my entire life. And that weekend, God put you in my path, and you fought for my heart and fought for who I am in more ways than I can thank you for. I got to share my story with you, and then you got to bring interpretation as a father almost to me. And then through you, Jesus came and healed big parts of my soul. And that was the beginning of the last decade of incredible healing, restoration, initiation, transformation as a man. And so before we get into anything else, I want to say thank you again. Thank you for your yes. Thank you for fighting for me. And since that retreat for the last 10 years, you've been in my life as a friend and as an incredible mentor. I've admired you as a person, as a husband, as a father, and then as a writer, as a man in the kingdom, in incredible ways. So thank you for who you are. Thank you for your yes.
Pablo, yeah, thank you. It's when I look back at our friendship, and you mentioned that it was almost 10 years ago, in some ways that seems like yesterday, but most of the ways it seems like that was a lifetime ago, because it feels like I've known you forever, and you've been a part of my life. It feels like just for so long now, because the roots go so deep. And I love our friendship. I love who you are and what God has done in your life in the last decade, both personally and then externally on a ministry front. Like, It is phenomenal to see, and this podcast is one piece of that fruit. But I love getting to have a vantage point to see what God's doing in, through you, with your family, with the people in your life, the men whose heart you fight for. Like, well done, man.
Thank you, brother. Thank you, Alan. Thanks so much. And I think for the Wild Sons community, for the men and the people watching this podcast or listening to it, I would love it if you share a bit of who is Alan Arnold, right? The topic of our conversation today is Risking the Real. Risk the Real is a book that you wrote recently, but I'd love to maybe explore, before we get into the topic of the book and the themes that we have been longing to talk about, how did you get to where you are today? Who was Alan before? Who is Alan today, and what a little bit of your journey, if you don't mind.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I would say the man I am today is absolutely still in process, but the journey is one that I never would have imagined as a boy. I think the enemy from early on had tried to make it as impossible for me to be who I am today as imaginable. I grew up in a family, a mom and dad, they were together until they divorced when I was probably 14, 15. But even when they were together, it was a house, Pablo, where I was loved, but nothing ever went deep. Conversation didn't go deep, no interpretation. There was no larger story. We went to church, but there was no understanding of intimacy with God or even any conversation or thought about outside of that hour or two on Sunday, how to live with God. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up kind of untethered to any deeper story or meaning. And when a young man finds himself there, which most young men do, I think the thrust is to pleasure or to find some kind of relief. And so that's what I was doing. And I never had someone to really interpret what is the meaning that we were created for. And so that was a journey that took me, those questions unanswered, into my 20s. I became a very hardworking, very driven man. When I was in college and right out of college, I saw the woman as the beauty to take away the hardness of the world and the drivenness in me. And so, you know, during college and my first years out of college, I probably went on close to 1,000 first dates. I'm serious. Like that's because I wow. learned really well how to have a first date with a beautiful woman, but I didn't know how to invest in her. I saw her as the adventure. Yeah. I didn't offer an adventure to her. And so you could get away with that on a first date, but you couldn't get away with that in a long-term relationship. And yet I'd never seen.
I imagine, Alan, that if you had not been used to going deep in your family or with anyone, right? Like how do you go from the typical surface level conversation of the first date into deeper issues of the heart if you had never lived in that place?
Exactly. And so it was a life of surface. It was a life of things looked good. It was momentary distraction and pleasure, and then work 80 hours a week, you know, and try to drive my career that way. So it really was, that defined my 20s. And thankfully, I realized at some point that in my 30s, I started to realize this is not sustainable. This is not, I'm empty inside. There's got to be more, but I'm not finding it either in work. And I was getting promoted and I was getting new titles and I had bigger teams underneath me. So success on that side, success on going out with a lot of different women and things like that, but nothing internal that lasted or mattered. I didn't know God in any kind of intimacy. I believed in him. I hoped he would come through if I ever needed him, but I didn't want to bother him.
Yeah.
And that striving and drivenness got to a point where, you know this story, Pablo, but it played out finally at this level where I was on a plane. I was on a trip and I was at the airport and we had gone partially to this venue where we were filming an author and I was in publishing. And I was on my phone, not paying attention. And they boarded the plane. It was like a commuter plane of about 100 and something people, 200 people. And I wasn't paying attention. The video crew got on it. I was still in my own world. I look up, the doors closed to board the plane. I run up to the counter. The woman tells me who works there, no, I'm sorry. The flight's full. We gave your seat away. We called your name. We gave it away. And you'll have to catch another flight. Well, I was so driven. This was before 9/11, thankfully, but I was so driven that I just watched her walk away And it wasn't even really anything I wrestled with. I just waited. She walked off. I opened the emergency door, walked out on the tarmac, and stood in front of the plane. I had my briefcase in my hand, and I'm just standing there as a face-off with the plane. And I knew I would get on that plane.
Yeah, this is my plane. This is my trip. No one is going to take this away from me.
I've got my ticket.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I'm getting on. And the door opens to the plane, and the co-pilot comes out on the runway, and he's like, "Who are you? What are you doing?" And I said, "Here's my ticket. I need to be on this plane." And within about 5 minutes, I had talked my way onto the plane. They kicked the other guy out who they'd given the seat to on standby. And that was kind of normal operating procedure for me at that time. I was a man who would make it happen if there were 100, you know, people trying to vie for some new account at work or to secure some new concept. I knew I would be the last man standing. I knew I would be the guy to make it happen. And I was like almost always the one that did do that, including, you know, stopping a plane. But I was so empty inside, and it was those adrenaline rushes and dopamine hits would happen. But I knew this was not a life that I wanted to live. And finally, my boss at that time, I thought he was going to give me another promotion. He invites me to a lunch, and it's the two of us. And he just said, "Hey, Alan, I just have to ask you, do you know all 20 something people on your team think you're a complete asshole?" Well, we were making bonuses. We were like the most successful team within that large corporation at the time. And I was like, "No, I didn't know that. And we're doing really well." And he said, "Yeah, you're doing well. And that's why they stay, for your productivity, but they can't stand your presence." And that, Pablo, was such a blow, a crippling blow. But I felt everything in me in the moment wanting to fight it, to fire everybody on the team and rebuild it to a more grateful team. But thankfully, God pulled me by the back, kind of cuff of my shirt, and was like, "Just stop, just pause, just take it in." And it felt like a basketball to the gut, you know, where you just lose your breath. You can't breathe because something just punched you in the gut. And yet I knew what he was saying. There was something there. And that was the beginning of a long turnaround journey to becoming a man who I didn't know what this meant at the time, but a man who people wanted for his presence because he actually cared about them and saw them, and who actually was using his strength for good. And I knew the only way to do that was to be fathered, because I had never been fathered in a way that gave me that kind of understanding of life. So that was the beginning.
Alan, I see, number one, it's really hard to picture you in that situation, because I never met that Alan. I have met the man who is heart-centric, who lives in union with God, who is exemplifies the love of the Father. And so it's really hard for me to imagine you with a briefcase just burging through the emergency door and lead, follow, get out of the way type of thing, right? At some point in my story, I remember many years ago, we were on a vacation with the kids, and it had been really hard to put everyone in the truck and luggage and pack it and drive all the way. We finally made it to the place, and we put our stuff away. We're in this beautiful cabin in the Tetons. And that evening, I sat with my wife outside. We put two foldable chairs to watch the beautiful sky, and I grab a bottle of wine just to celebrate that we were in this beautiful place. But it had not been easy to get there. And then, so I gave her the glass of wine and cheers, honey. And what she said reminded me of what the story you just told. She said, "Pablo, sometimes living with you is like living with a sergeant set on his ways, who is more concerned with accomplishing his mission than with caring for the people that God has given him."
Wow.
it was like that. Whoa.
Yes.
Right. I, of course, immediately wanted to tell her the 110 reasons why she was wrong and how unfair her comment was. And she's misinterpreting. And I'm the one trying to do this and this and that. And I'm doing all of this for you, all of that, which really was circumstantially true. For much deeper than that, she was absolutely right. And it led me on a journey of trying to understand what is it that my heart needed? What was it that my heart was longing for? Which is part of what I see in your story. There was a deeper cry within you. Yes, I'm successful. Yes, I can accomplish all the missions. I can get the deals done. But there's got to be more to life than that, right? And
right.
It feels like everyone is chasing after that story, but it doesn't fulfill. It's like that treadmill, more and more, the next deal, the next thing, the next thing, the next thing, and the emptiness doesn't go away.
Exactly. The productivity was not satisfying it. Even when I knew I could take on more and do more and was given more, I was simply working more of my life away, you know, because I wanted that validation. And then I was looking for relief at that time in dating, in the mm-hmm. beauty.
Yes.
I was looking for it in some kind of just, please God, I need relief, but I'm looking for relief even in the wrong way, because I wasn't looking for God for my validation and I wasn't mm-hmm. looking for God for my relief or my restoration. Mm-hmm. I was trying to live as this self-made man, and it was just an implosion that the only question was, when would the implosion mm-hmm. happen? If I didn't yeah. turn proactively and seek something different, it was going to be a very messy, very public implosion. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, that moment came where I raised the white flag and just said, God, I don't even know what it means for you to be my father. I don't know how to be a son. I've always been a doer. I have no idea how to be. Mm-hmm. But I can't do this life of doing anymore. Mm-hmm. I can't. Mm-hmm. And if it's in some ways, if that life had never worked, it would have probably happened a lot sooner. But because the illusion was that it was working, because everybody in terms of the people that hired me, my bosses, my clients, like they were more than fine for me to be the make it happen, get it done mm-hmm. guy when nobody else could. So I was rewarded for the very thing that was causing me to slowly implode. And, if I hadn't raised that white flag, Pablo, and just said, God, I have to have you. And I don't even know, I need to be a son, but I have no idea what a son is. I don't even know if I would be alive today, but that happened, thankfully, starting in my mid-30s, late 30s. And really the 40s was my first full decade of living as a son.
Wow. And the man that you have become has now, because of that, yes, you've been able to love and to father and to mentor and to guide me and many others. And you've become a voice that we want to hear, because your message is not coming from an idea that you read about somewhere or that sounds catchy and therefore you want to make a big buck out of it. It comes as a result of the man that you have become. And so we live now in this age of AI. The last year has been pretty crazy. And so I didn't know that you were writing the book that you released recently, but suddenly one day you just sent me a picture, a screenshot of the book in Amazon. So I was like, wow, this is amazing. You've become a pretty, generous writer. You've been writing a few books in the last few years. And I love them. I love them all. And so I went and bought it. And the name of the book is Risk the Real. I have it right here with me. And How to Defy the Rise of the Artificial. So when I first read the book, I imagined you were going to talk about ChatGPT and the rise of, AI, and which is, interesting to me. I worked for 20 years in technology. And so I was really interested in that topic and your take on it. But as I began to read it, I realized that the book was about something much, much, much deeper than that. And of course, you're touching on artificial intelligence. But it takes us back. It's, I don't want to give it away. Tell me about Risk the Real. Tell me about your heart for it and how you got to write it. And what is that core message that you want to convey through it?
Yeah. So this book feels like the most timely book I've ever written. It's my fifth, but it came the fastest and it felt the most urgent. And I even had people who I respect as intercessors and prayer warriors. They started reaching out to me, Pablo, as I began to write this. They didn't know I was writing a book. They weren't my specific intercessors. But they would reach out to me and say things like, God woke me up at 4 this morning and said, tell Alan this morning that he has to write that book now. And they didn't even know I was writing a book. And so I started hearing that and sensing that this is not just something to say, but something to say now for this moment in time, because I really feel like the clash between the real and the artificial is intensifying. And where I first was stirred to write this was I started noticing something in me would rise up when it felt like the artificial was gaining an inroad in my life. And at first I took that to mean our screens, right? Like, how often am I looking at my phone? Not because I have to, but because I'm bored, or because I need a distraction, or because I'm looking for some form of life in this pixelized screen that I think it can provide. And so over the recent months and even past year or so, I've tried to make my phone as irrelevant as possible. I've taken apps off of it. I have taken the ability to be on the internet off of it. I've taken my email off of it. So basically, I have tried to make my high-tech current model iPhone a brick where I can only use it to call people or possibly for a text or navigation and maybe some photos, but that's it. And my whole goal in that was to spend less and less time staring into a screen, because as you probably noticed, Pablo, like when you go to dinner, lunch with your kids, your family, a friend, if you just look around, pretty much everybody in the entire restaurant who's eating there, who's with other people, the wait staff, the hostess, everybody is staring into their screen. And it really began to bug me that what's going on here? Like, we're all losing not only our grasp of what's real, but we're becoming less real in the process. We're becoming more unreal because of this tether to the artificial. And then I realized, but actually it's not just technology. Technology is the most obvious, most current, bright, shiny object before us, ChatGPT, AI, our phones, you name it. But like anything, it always helps to go back to the origin. You know, if you're watching a superhero movie, well, what's the origin of Iron Man? What's the origin of Batman? You know, well, what's the origin of the artificial? And God took me all the way back to Eden and said, you know, Alan, the first appearance of the artificial to humanity was when the enemy, as the serpent, offered a counterfeit or artificial narrative to our story. At the point that he said, no. Yeah, God's told you the story of how he is, how life works, who you were created to be, but that's not the real story. There's a better, faster story to becoming like God's. And here it is. And so, Pablo, that was for me this moment where I realized the artificial is anything that lures us away from God, that tries to replace God in our life or make him irrelevant. And in that sense, your grandfather, my grandfather, their grandfathers, all the way back to Adam, 13th century, 4th century, they've always had to deal with the artificial, meaning this thing that is the counterfeit to God's desire for our life. And we see it play out now in mixed reality and virtual reality and all these high-tech ways that are really harder than ever not to get sucked into the artificial. But it began in Eden, and in that sense, the battle has always been, will we choose the most real, which is God, the one who created reality, or will we get sucked into a life of the artificial and become less real ourselves?
Alan, it's such a radical idea and such an important concept for each of us to understand. What I'm hearing you say in what you're unpacking is God created the world, created us so that he could live in union with us, so that we could live in union with him, to flourish as a result of our union with him, to talk to him, to do with him, to walk with him, and as a result of that union, to experience freedom and joy and peace and love and all the things that we long for and all these things that we strive for. Those are the fruit of a life that is rooted in that union with him. And that was his creation. That was his design. That's what he established in Eden. But in order to allow Adam and Eve at the time, and each of us every single day, he had to create the capacity, give us the choice to reject him in order that we could have the choice to accept him and to live with him. And therefore, there were two trees, the tree of life and the tree of knowledge and good and evil.
Right.
The invitation is, come. You're longing for life, right? I almost see it in the description of the man that you were, right? That man bursting into this plane because he has his seat. All of that is expressions of your longing for life, believing that life will be found in accomplishments, in success, in the next promotion, in the next thing. When in fact, life is only found by design as a result of our union with God. And so Adam and Eve chose an alternative. They chose a counterfeit. They bought the lie from the evil one, and they said, there is a better path. I hear you, God, but I think that I can accomplish what my heart longs for in my own ways, and therefore I'm going to eat from the tree of knowledge and good and evil, which is the only thing that you have told me that I cannot do. And we're repeating that choice every single day. And what I'm hearing you unpacking that is that every one of these choices we're making to go for the counterfeit, for the artificial, for the less, John Eldridge describes it as the less wild lovers in the sacred romance. Whether it is more work or the screen or the third beer at night or the joint or the drugs or the pornography or wherever it is that we think that we can find life, it's nothing but a counterfeit of what God designed for us to experience, which is true life in union with him. Am I going too far? Is that how you're...
That's exactly it. It's exactly it. And you look back to the serpent's lie, the counterfeit, the artificial narrative to Adam and Eve. Well, he also used that same counterfeit narrative to the angels. Hmm. A third of the angels before the rebellion in heaven were swayed by another story. And these were angelic beings who God created, who saw God face to face. And somehow this other created being, Lucifer, convinces one out of three of these angelic beings through a story that's not true to turn against their creator. And so he did it in Eden. He had done it with the angelic beings before. And it all is rooted back in, they say there was, you know, if you read in like Ezekiel and other Old Testament scripture, there was pride in his heart. And so this angelic being, Lucifer, at some point, one of the highest angelic ranking, you know, creatures, angelic beings, decided, no, I want the story to be about me. I don't like the story. I want to recreate reality where I am at the center. And if I go that path, I bet I can get a lot of the angelic beings. And eventually then in Eden, I bet I can get humanity to buy into that same thing that has caused my heart to go dark and has caused me to rebel against the reality that God has made. And so, Pablo, we're all getting caught up in this.
Yes.
And at the root of it, like you said, the tree of life or the tree of knowledge, every decision we make today, one thing I try to do in the book is break through this this thought that most people have today, which is, it's, you hear this phrase a lot, it's complicated, whatever the topic is. Whether the topic is on politics, whether the topic is on, you know, gender, whether the topic is on, you know, entertainment options, technology, it's complicated. And I just, in the book, try to help people understand, actually, God, although his ways are well beyond our ways, and he is beyond us exponentially, his interaction with us is relatively simple. His instructions for life are relatively simple. There's a tree of life and a tree of knowledge of good and evil. Every decision we make, I believe, taps into one of those two root systems. In other words, there's no neutral third or fourth or fifth tree. There weren't 7,000 trees and we all pick our own favorite color tree. Oh, I like the polka dot tree. Oh, I like the ocean blue tree. You know, I like this fruit. I like that fruit. God ultimately said, no, there's two trees in the center of the garden. There are two trees. You have to choose one. And the root systems that we tap into when we make choices about work, about family life, about entertainment choices, all these education systems, all these things ultimately have to tap in to one of those two root systems. And it's either the real or the artificial.
So Alan, then along with that, and you break this down beautifully in the book, what is real? Last night I happened to watch The Matrix with my son. The first time he watches it, so for me it was an important moment. In my opinion, it's the greatest movie of all times. And as I'm watching it, I know you quoted in the book, there's this scene where Neo is walking into this room to meet Morpheus for the same time. For the first time, and he gets, you know, the blue pill and the red pill. Do you want to know what the Matrix is? Do you want to understand the system that you have been a slave in into all these days? And when he does, first he needs context. He needs to understand what the heck is going on here, because I don't know where I am. I don't know where I have been. Give me some interpretation. Shine your light so that I may be able to see and understand. And so they go into this computer program, into the construct, they call it, which is their loading program, where anything can happen. So now Neo is inside this computer program with Morpheus.
Yes.
And he says, this isn't real. And Morpheus tells him, well, what is real? How do you define real? If real is only what you can smell and you can see and you can taste and you can touch, then real is nothing but electrical signals interpreted by your brain.
Exactly.
What is real?
The Matrix and that whole concept of what is real, like that, I think is the main question that determines the course of our life. Mm-hmm. And not only what is real, but who gets to determine that in a world that's becoming more artificial. And so right now, I think culture around us has decided we, humanity, individuals, we get to decide what's real. And the problem is, when you start trying to create your own reality, you think then that you can create your own morality. If I can create my own reality and define who I am and define how the world works, then part of that is I get to design and customize my own morality. Mm-hmm. And so now what's good and what's evil, the tree of knowledge of good and evil, I get to decide.
Yes, completely and relative
to
me.
Eat of whatever I want to eat of. And you may know of this individual, I don't know, Pablo, his name's Paul Kingsnorth, but he's written a lot about the machine, about the times we're in, and looking at the, you know, just the way we are all being kind of led into this dystopian future. He's a believer. But one thing he said recently is, It's like we're living in the Matrix, but written from the point of view in which Agent Smith is the good guy. Like, that's where we find ourselves, is no longer is, do we want to be Neo, the one breaking out of the Matrix? We somehow want to be Agent Smith, who is defending the artificial and who is fighting against anything that's trying to bring reality. And a thing to just for the listeners and for us to kind of riff on a second is, God didn't just say, this is what reality is like. He created reality. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, some question with modern man and woman is God real? Well, they're putting God under the category of reality. Here's reality. We just want to know, does God fit in reality? And it's backwards, right? Like, there was no reality. God created reality. And so he gets to say, what is real? How we should live? What is real love? What is real life? What is real sacrifice? What is really worth pursuing and risking? Well, we can come up with our own definitions, but God's already defined that for us because he's created reality and then created us within it and said, this is how to live a life that matters. And you don't get to design your own reality. You don't get to create reality. Real is not how you feel. You may feel a certain way, but that's not what's real necessarily if it misaligns with what God says. So I think it starts in the book with five tenets that I take readers through of what are the tenets of the real? Well, the first one is God created reality. Like, that sets the tone and the pace, I think, for what follows. Because if you know God created reality, then it's good to get to know, if he's the creator of reality, what does that mean? And the second tenet is then our reality must be rooted in him. The third tenet, union with God, recreates us. And I go through these five tenets. Those are just the first three. But my point is, we have to begin there, because if we don't begin with the real, we'll always be more enamored with the bright, shiny new thing that promises godhood. And we may not use the term godhood. We may just say, I want to create my own life, my own reality. I want to do it my way. But that's what we're saying. We're saying we want to be at the center of our world, of our reality. And that's the very same lie that started, you know, with the serpent in the garden. And it's going forward, and we can see it never plays out well.
And in that, which you're bringing up, that is the lie that they came to believe. That is the reason why they reached out and ate of the tree of knowledge and good and evil, not of the tree of life. Rooted in a misconception of who God is, which I think is at the center of the choice even today, right? When I am exhausted and I turn on Netflix to binge a show for 5 hours without a conscious thought, what I'm doing is my soul is in need for something. I'm going to create a way to soothe that need in my own way. Right. And so the 5 hours of Netflix is my approach to try to bring some relief to the place, to the way that my soul needs, when in fact my soul needs restoration. And instead of the knowledge of good and evil, so to speak, the counterfeit, the lie, if I had chosen union with God and going to the real, and maybe in my case, sitting around the fire in silence at night and watch the stars above me and then just pray and receive the life of God in the real, my soul would actually flourish and thrive. But there is this underlying lie, which is what I believe, what, you know, we know that Adam and Eve did, which was God is somehow holding out on me. And therefore, I have to choose my own reality. I have to choose based on my feelings. I have to choose based on my own opinions, on my view of reality, which is the all the discussions in social media and in everywhere today, because I don't fully believe that God and what he's offering me is really what will lead me to life.
Exactly. It's like I was in Australia a few months ago, and I was in an ally's home. And he had on his wall this painting of these words, and it was framed, and it was simple, but it said, I already have all I need. And I just stood in front of that, Pablo, and the immediate thought was, well, of course, right, we do. But quickly I realized, but I don't live that. We don't live that way.
Yeah.
And Adam and Eve, that goes back to the lie you're talking about that God's holding out. If we really thought we had all we need, we wouldn't have multiple purchases on Amazon every week for the thing we think we need to make our life better.
Yeah.
Like Amazon would go out of business overnight if everybody realized, actually, I really believe deep down, I have all I need. If I have God, I have all I need. He will provide for all my needs. I don't have to stand in front of a plane. I don't have to be the bull in the china shop. Mm-hmm. I don't have to look to alcohol or pornography or a promotion or working out 3 hours at the gym every day to somehow become all I'm supposed to be or need. I have all I need. Now, can I operate as a son or daughter from that place? And so, yeah, I think that that is the lie that began the erosion into the artificial.
Mm.
And we have to realize when we embrace that lie, we're embracing the very lie that caused Lucifer's downfall. I mean, that was the lie that separated him and created all of the chaos, all of the good versus evil fallen world that we're in. It began in a creature's heart, a created being's heart that felt like, you're holding out on me. I want to be God in this story. I want to be the one worshiped. I want to be the one people follow. I don't want the role that I've been given in the narrative. So my only choice is to try to blow up that story because of a false belief, because of envy, because of jealousy, because of ego. And so we have to realize when we're doing that, we're not just in the footsteps of Adam. We're actually in the footsteps of our enemy.
Wow.
Like if you keep going back in the story, mm-hmm. it's, you know, and that one thing is what keeps us, I believe, in the artificial, which again is, how do we do life without God? How can we get what we want now? ChatGPT gives me an answer to my question in 2 seconds. God, I asked him this last week. I still haven't heard the answer. I'll go with ChatGPT. Yeah. You know, it's that kind of fascination we have now with the wrong things.
Yeah, I was sitting, that reminded me of sorry, I was sitting with a friend having coffee a couple of weeks ago, and he's been receiving the newsletters, the free newsletter that we offered, the Wild Sons Weekly. And he said, hey, those articles are awesome. I'm really enjoying that. Tell me, how do you write those? What do you mean? Yeah. How what's your process like? Like, what do you do? Well, I sit down and I pray and I invite Jesus to tell me what he has for the community, and I begin to write, and I wrestled this and walk with God through it. And he said, no, but what I mean, those are not written by ChatGPT.
Oh my gosh.
Of course they're not written by ChatGPT. Also, you write those yourself? And he was surprised because, right, it's not the most efficient way of doing things. It sounded weird to him. The easier thing, I guess, would be to go to ChatGPT and ask it to write an article on whatever topic.
Which, Pablo, this just drives me insane, things like that. And it's believers oftentimes, I don't know if this particular person was or not, but we see like churches in the book, I give an example in Austin, there was a church service that not too long ago let AI lead the whole service. It picked the songs. It wrote some songs. It wrote the sermon. It like they turned it over to the artificial, and to just go, what, like, how do we ever think that the artificial can help us know more about God or the most real? Like, God doesn't, you know, and AI hasn't been around that long, but we already are conditioned now to be surprised that we can actually be creative without the artificial. It's bizarre. It's like books are being written, novels are being written, nonfiction is being written on Amazon. You can buy books in the thousands now that AI wrote. right now that were written by AI. And we're going to read that and then decide how to live and what's important. And we're letting the artificial tell us how to live a more real life. Like we are in the Twilight Zone, bizarro land. And that's part of my book's call, like, is how do we get back to what matters most? And we have to break away from these tentacles of dependence and fascination with the artificial.
Yeah. And so, and your invitation in that place is to risk the real. And so you've done a beautiful job helping us grasp, you know, understand the concept of what is real and then what is the artificial, not just screens, not just ChatGPT versus, you know, writing with pen and paper. We're not talking about that. It's the choice of God and the reality that he created and union with him and all that he is and he offers, or our own way to try to make life work apart from him. And so how do we, in the book, you explain how the choice now is to begin risking to move in the direction of the real. What do you mean by risk, and how do we do it, right? We do live in 2024. And even now, we're doing this podcast virtually because we don't live three doors from each other, and this is better than nothing.
Right.
And it's never going to replace being in the same place or being around the fire together and sharing on a cigar. But this is better than nothing, I guess, right? And so how do we begin risking towards the real, while at the same time understanding we do live in 2024, we cannot just move to a cabin and become hermits there. But
right.
How do we not just use that as an excuse to say, well, we live in 2024, so I just have to. And so I'll have ChatGPT write my newsletters. How do we begin risking to move in the right direction, in the direction of the real?
Yeah, great question. Well, so in the book, I start off just kind of giving us a fresh glimpse of even understanding risk. And so one of the things I say, I'm just going to read you a few sentences from the book, but I say, it's important to know our typical response to risk, but even more helpful is to understand God's original intention for our relationship with risk. After all, risk was his idea. He created Adam and Eve and put them in a situation where they had to risk. He gave them the ability to choose, which was risky. But what if everything we thought we knew about risk was wrong or only partial? What if the real problem was never risk itself, but our broken relationship with it and our go-to reaction to risk? First, a few foundational thoughts to reorient us to what risk is. Vague risk is never helpful. How will you even know if the objective was accomplished if you can't put words to it? The goal isn't to be a generic risk taker, but a person who risks well with God. And so I go from there into, Pablo, helping people understand first, risk is normal and necessary. We risk multiple times every day. We risk on things we don't even realize. When we go to a restaurant, we risk that we trust the chef who we've never met not to poison our food. Maybe not to spit in our food, if that's a more, you know, believable option. We risk getting on a plane. We don't know the pilot. We risk when we get into our vehicles that the people driving by us know how to drive. We risk sometimes in ways that we pull back and we think we're being safe, but we're actually risking far more, because when you don't burn the boats, when you're not all in, then you are risking a life of self-dependence and of backup plans that you are going to come through if God doesn't come through. You're going to make it happen, right? So risk, whether we go, we're really risk averse, we don't like risk, so we've minimized it in our life, we don't even try to have any, that's never going to work. And the other side, oh, we love risk. We eat risk for breakfast, man. I'll risk anything. I'll go to Vegas and risk it all. Like, that's not the right risk either. So it's not risk foolishly, and it's not try to pretend you can get away with no risk. It's how to risk boldly, but do so with God, where you are all in. And the last thing I'll just add on that is, if you want to see examples of what that looked like, Charles Spurgeon has this quote that says, to risk all with Jesus is to end all risk. In other words, it is risking everything to say yes and follow Jesus. But when you do, it ends all the fear of a life that is up to you. And so you're risking for the only thing that matters. And when you do that, it ends this heaviness of risk. And every great Bible story we love, whether it's Paul, Daniel, David, Noah, Esther, Abraham, especially the life of Jesus, you look at and you say, they were all in. Mm. Like, they risked being in the lion's den. They risked building a boat when there had never been a flood. They risked all these different ways for what mattered most. And it wasn't the artificial narrative around them at that time, which was, no, the what Rome says matters most, right? Or what makes you financially stable is what matters most, or what makes a name for yourself matters most. If that's what they had risked, we wouldn't be telling their stories today. Mm-hmm. And we can live those kind of stories if we'll risk well for what matters the most.
And so what I'm hearing you saying that, Alan, is again, going back to wrestling with a question we were riffing on, can I put my trust in God? Can I choose to believe wholeheartedly as a believer, not just nominally as a Christian, right? And still doing my own thing, but from the depths of my heart to put all my chips on God. You called it in the book, what is your north? And you guided us to this was really, by the way, really revealing to me just to pause and to ask myself that question. What is my true north for real? In practical terms, what do my schedule and my budget and the way that the things that I'm emotionally tied to and my thought life, what do they reveal about what my North Star is? And you mentioned some options. Is it work, family, hobbies, tradition, church, entertainment, home, community, beliefs, pleasures, efficiency, success, facts, science, arts? There are a long list. I would say, of course not. It's God. It's got us in his life. Well, really? Then why does your budget and your schedule and your emotional life reveal something else? And so to even start there, if I'm understanding correctly your invitation and to reflect, am I all in with God and his life? In other words, does my heart fully believe that everything that I need can be found in him? Not in him and my success, right. Not in him and the next sale, not in him and the beach vacation, not in him and the other thing that I just crave and long for, not in him and Netflix, not in him and the next glass of wine. Can I put my chips, all of it, all in? Can I burn the ships and say, I don't have a plan B?
Right.
And if so, then how can that guide my daily thoughts and my daily decisions to risk saying, if that is true, I'm going to say no to this right now. If that is true, I'm not going to allow ChatGPT to write my newsletter. I'm going to get on my knees and listen to the heart of the Father for what he has to express to his people through our community. If I am all in, then can I choose that I can find the joy and the restoration and what my soul needs Friday night when I'm fried instead of opening the bottle of wine? And risking on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, on a monthly basis in that direction, hoping, trusting God that over time, the fruit that I will experience in my soul and in my life and in my marriage and in my family is the fruit of the real.
And that's a risk, but it's the all in risk, the only one that's worth taking. Because like you were saying about ChatGPT, yes. If all it takes for us to get distracted or lured away from who God created us to be is, say, efficiency. Oh, well, if you use ChatGPT, it's so much more efficient. If that's the thing that will go, well, okay, yeah, I do want to be an efficient man. So I guess I'll make a compromise there. I'll trade my integrity, my creativity for something artificial. Then we make a trade right there. We're not all in. And somebody may say, well, but what's wrong with that? It's just being more efficient. But the thing is, God didn't create us with a need to be enhanced by artificial means. When he said, Pablo, create with me, I want to show you things, Jeremiah 33:3, beyond your wildest imagination, if you'll do it with me. He didn't say, but of course you're going to need ChatGPT along the way, because I can show you things somewhat beyond your imagination, but ChatGPT or virtual reality or mixed reality, whoa, that's what you need. And so anytime we think in our mind, well, yeah, I'm going to do this with God, but I'm actually going to depend on these other things that weren't even around years ago, but now are indispensable. You have to take a look back at your assumptions, because if we don't, and this is a sobering thought, but I'm just going to say this, if we don't, we will bow the knee to something other than God, guaranteed. If we're not all in, we will at some point be offered something where we say, actually, this is more of life. Actually, this is my ticket to be financially independent. Actually, if I do this, I can have far more pleasure than I ever imagined. And we will bow the knee to that person or that organization or that thing, and we will choose the wrong tree if we're not all in. If Adam and Eve had been all in, the serpent only could tempt them. The serpent couldn't make them, right? It was their choice. If they were all in, even if they didn't understand 100%, obviously, of all that would follow, if they were simply all in on, I believe, 100% God in his story, when the serpent said that and offered that artificial narrative, they would have laughed. They would have walked away. At the very least, they would have said, hold on, we're going to go back to our Father and Creator, and we're going to have a conversation around the fire pit tonight. God, is this, is it really true if we ate from this tree that, you know, and the serpent, who seems to not like you very much, is telling us these things. If they had been all in, no matter what the lie was, their knee would not have bowed to the artificial. And the beautiful thing is, as sad as that was, and all the tragedy that has, through the history of time, has come against all of us, the beautiful thing is, we still have a choice not to bow the knee. But the only way is all in. If we're 99% in, we will bow the knee, because the enemy will use that 1% in a way that we can't fathom. One day, maybe 5 years from now, maybe tomorrow, where we go, okay, like, actually, I'm going to take this. I'm going to do this. And I think it'll be okay. And at that moment, we have bowed the knee to the artificial. And we have turned to look to something besides God for life.
Let me share a recent journey that Jesus took me through. And see, I love your thoughts and your reflection, and see through my example, if I'm hearing you correctly. Nutrition is an important thing. Feeding our bodies properly, because it's a temple of God, it's important.
Yes.
And so I've been diving into different nutritional paths and diets and things to see what resonates better with my body. And with a friend of both of us, we started experimenting with animal-based diet and carnivore diet and this and this and that. And I began to see the effects in my body, feeling more energy, feeling stronger, feeling leaner, really good, feeling really well. And part of what I was doing, I wasn't realizing it at the time, was moving away from a lot of the quote-unquote artificial crap that I ate on a daily basis, all stuff that has been mass produced and made in order to make people money, but not in order to offer nutrition, proper nutrition to a human being. All of that's great so far. But as I continued diving into this, I got more curious and I began to search in YouTube for, you know, doctors that are explaining more of this nutritional thing. And then I didn't realize it at the time, but I was spending quite a bit of time trying to understand all the effects of each one of these different fruit sources and specific foods themselves. And I was going down this rabbit trail again through the lens of eating food is important. God gave us food to nurture and nourish our bodies. we should do it in a healthy way. But I was beginning to go down that path. And what Jesus brought into me was, what he brought up to me was the revelation that I was putting my hopes in life in the diet that I was choosing. It started properly. It started well. And right. I began to see the good things. But it was not Jesus as the source of life. It is this diet as the source of life, or these nutritional choices as the source of life. And then to begin, I began to know more about the people who were making those choices, and they began to become like my tribe. And I was being pulled in that direction almost in a cultish way. I'm using that as an example because it's not necessarily technology, it's not screens, it's not something that it's as obvious as it is. And it wasn't a black and white. It was not easy for me to see, because we're not talking about, oh, Pablo's choosing cocaine instead of Jesus. Well, that's an obvious choice.
Right.
It is something that I have to eat every day, something that God created to feed me. It's something that was giving me life, so to speak, making me feel better, losing some extra weight that I didn't want to have, and feeling more energy, showing up better in my home and at work. But it became Jesus and. And so it's not that I'm going back to the trash food that I was eating before, the unhealthy food that I was eating before.
Right.
But I had to go through this journey of disentangling from that as the source of life and going back to Jesus as the source of life, and then walking with him as the only source of life, and with him in union with it, then making good choices from a nutrition perspective. Reactions to that, Alan, how do you see it?
Yeah. I think it reminds me, as you said, it is good to be aware of our health, to eat properly, to seek out real food versus artificial ingredients and mm-hmm. some, you know, things that are added to our diet. That is good. But like you named, Pablo, the good can quickly become what we look to for the source of life. And that's not good. And it reminds me, in Isaiah, there's the story of the woodsman, and he's out and he plants seeds and raises trees. And Isaiah tells the story of a woodsman who takes care of the forest. He takes a tree at some point, cuts it down, and decides he's going to use it to warm his food. So he chops it up into wood. He warms and heats himself. He cooks on it, and that's good. But then he uses the other half of that wood of the chopped tree to carve an idol. Mm. And he carves the idol, and then it says he bows down before it and says, "Save me, you are my God." And to me, that's an exact kind of parallel to what you're describing. And we could use any number of stories, whether it's working out, whether it's education, you know, religion, mm-hmm. where we're learning a lot about God, about Old Testament mm-hmm. history, all these things that are good. But at some point, just like in the woodsman story, we go from warming ourselves and heating our food to seeing that thing, that overall piece of wood, is not just used for good, but it becomes an idol. And we look to it and say, "You're my God, save me. If I do this program, if I keep doing this faithfully every day, if I research more." And I think we know when we're on that path, when we're more fascinated and intrigued and lured to that thing than we are to God. When we spend more time researching and studying and talking about and buying and experimenting with things or groups or vacations or hobbies, mm-hmm. you know, nutrition. And we spend more time on that and go, okay, I think there's a problem, because I'm suddenly looking to this more for life than God. I'm more fascinated mm-hmm. by the new iPhone that's coming out mm-hmm. than I am about this character trait of God. Mm-hmm. I'm more fascinated to try this new virtual reality or mixed reality experience than I am to actually read Paul's letter to the you know, the group in Ephesus. Like, what's going on when all these things feel like more life than the creator of life? So it's, that to me is the litmus test.
Super helpful, because that begins to give me a lens through which I can more practically make choices. So for instance, you ended your example with technology, which is one of the hardest for me. Then again, we're here. We're recording a virtual podcast instead of a real one sitting down. The ideal, like the purest form of what the real of the real would be, is you and I are sitting by a fire, having a cigar, having this conversation. Now, we had a camera and a mic so we can share that with people. We're beginning to add technology to it. Is that wrong? I don't know. We want this message to be heard by others. So no, I don't think so. Now we do it virtually. Is this wrong? Well, we don't have the capacity to sit down together face to face today. So this is better than not. So I'm not seeing the evil in the camera that is in front of you.
Right.
But I am seeing how easy it is for evil to come through the camera that is in front of you and get a hold of your heart to the point that you begin to depend and search for the technology and for the things as the source of life, as the source of efficiency and productivity and success that will give you life instead of looking to God himself.
Right. When Paul would speak to the Romans, he would he'd step onto a platform that was built by Romans, probably, right, or was certainly a platform they owned.
Yes.
And he would use that public space on their roads and in their city to proclaim words of life and to talk about God. Mm. And he would use those things. I think what we're doing right now is, I would say, we are using technology, but we are not letting it use us. Mm-hmm. We are not being used. In other words, my heart is not going out to the artificial in this. I'm not looking to it for more life. I'm not looking to how many views on the podcast or listens there are for validation. Right. Like, it doesn't, I think that's the question, is does it have a hold on you? Are you using it, or is it using you?
So helpful.
And just like Paul and others, you will use anything at their disposal to preach the good news, to reach people. I'll use it. But the problem is, most of us are being used far more than we're using it. You just look at the hours a day on your phone usage, you know, like if you're tracking that kind of thing, and go, or look at how much you scroll mindlessly, or if your wife goes to the restroom at a restaurant, can you sit there and observe the room around you, ask God a question, or do you have to pick up your phone because you can't stand being bored or alone for 2.5 minutes? You know, and so those are the kind of things, Pablo, I think we have to ask ourselves. And I think most people think they're using technology, but it is using them. And so obviously I love air conditioning. I grew up in Texas. That's technology, right? I love driving my truck. That's technology. I love talking to you right now. This is technology, but we are not enamored with the technology. We're not trading part of our soul or our heart for what we're doing right now. And I think when people are addicted to it, they get anxious if they don't have their phone for 4 hours, if they can't calm down at the end of the day without vegging on a Netflix series. You know, there's an addiction and an anxiousness where it has us, a hold on us.
Yeah.
And so that's what the book goes into. It's not saying all technology is bad.
Yes.
It's saying, is it using you? Because there's only one winner in the end. You don't get to straddle the real and the artificial. Ultimately, you have to be all in, or you will be, in a sense, all out to whatever it is that holds your deepest attraction, whatever your North Star is, if it's not God.
Going back to the analogy of the Matrix, once they're unplugged from the Matrix, they come to grasp with the reality of the real world. And in the movie, is way easier to understand because it's a metaphor, right? It's a movie. And so you see the distinction. This is real and this is artificial. And so as a team, Neo and his crew, right, in the Nebuchadnezzar with Morpheus and Trinity, they understand perfectly, we are real and we live in the real world. We need to go into the matrix, but we go in with a mission. We are going in and using the system itself to set people free.
Yes.
But once we do that, we pull out and we live in the real world because this is real. And the matrix is a system that has been created to keep us as slaves. We may come in to set people free, to pull them out, but then we're out.
Right.
And those are the choices that we need to make daily, right?
Right. And when we do that, you just described, I think the matrix is so incredible at that, of saying we will use the system to defeat the system. Mm-hmm. And in this case, we will use technology and the artificial, depending on how, remember, the artificial isn't just technology, but it's anything that pulls us away from God. Yep. We will use those things that try to take the place of God or enamor us more than God to bring people to reality, to the real, but we won't partially become more fascinated with it and go, yeah, I'm going to use it some, and I'm going to carve myself a little bit of an idol with the rest of it and protect this space because this feels like life to me over here. I want both. And that's where you're in the most vulnerable spot possible.
That's spectacular. Thank you, Alan. I have a question, and I love to ask this question typically here in the podcast and maybe to begin to bring the plane for a landing. Through the lens of the man that you have become and your beautiful writings, especially this last one, if you could walk into that airport and from a distance first to look at Alan, who is on the phone and who is missing his last call to get on the plane, and then the plane is shot and he hasn't come to realize that, but if for some reason he's phone call got disconnected and you had a chance to sit down next to him for a brief moment and say some words to him, what would you tell him?
Wow, that's a powerful question. I don't know if the man I was would listen to the man I am right now. But what I would try to say to him is, this is not the way to life. This is not life. It's okay to let go, to trust that there's not just a God in the sky, but there's a Father who wants to come to your side and show you what it means to be a son. And it's never going to happen through doing more. You're never going to be more by this path of trying to do more. And I don't know if that man back then would have listened, because he was pretty hard-headed, pretty headstrong that he was going to make life work. But briefly, Pablo, I'll tell you, when I was in Australia, so our journey of sonship isn't a one and done. You know that really well. I mean, yeah. It is a lifelong journey as a son. But when I was in Australia, we were on mission with Wild at Heart, and God came from my heart in a way I had no expectation or even thought of. And while I was there, through a series of events, it got exposed to me that something had happened at 15 in my life that had fractured me and that was still at play. And I had somebody told me this, and I had no idea what they were talking about, but I asked God, and God within 24 hours revealed to me, yeah, when you were 15, Alan, you were in a car accident, and it was Halloween night, and it was my first night at age 15. I was a freshman in high school. I'd been for the first time out drinking at a party where there were no adults, seniors in high school. I drove two freshmen with me. I was on allergy medication, didn't think about how that would, and alcohol would interact. And about midnight on Halloween, we were leaving the party, driving home. I'm driving, I pass out as I'm driving. We're going about 45 miles an hour through a residential area. I cross the traffic lane, jump the curb at some point, go into a yard, thankfully a large yard with a lot of trees, and my car ricochets between these trees. None of us have seatbelts on. And all of a sudden, next thing I know, I wake up. The car's about 5 feet from the brick home before going into it. Smoke, it's totaled. I have blood on my face. My head had crashed, hit the windshield, and the windshield shattered. The two friends, none of us had seatbelts on. Two friends were gone. And the invitation from Jesus was, do you want to go back to that 15-year-old place? Because that is actually the root of the man you were, that you became through drivenness. And he took me back there. I'm just shortcutting this, but he took me back there. And when that wreck happened and I woke up and my friends were gone, I thought they've either died or they've left me to die. Like those were the only two options. They're dead or they ran away and left me to die. And it was about a 2-mile walk home and it's midnight, full moon, Halloween. And I'm walking home and it's so dark spiritually. And I made a lot of agreements on that walk home. Those 2 miles as a 15-year-old, I am alone. It is all up to me. I can't count on anyone.
Wow.
And I will make it happen from here. And there was a lot of shame in there too. And Jesus just came into that 2-mile walk and just asked me as my adult self, do you know, Alan, you've been on this walk for 40 years. You have been stuck for 40 years as the 15-year-old part of you has been lost on this walk. You don't want to go back to the wreck. You don't want to go home. Mm-hmm. You have no place to go. And so that part of you, that young place, led to the man who never had to depend on anybody and who would make it happen, because I knew if push came to shove and it was a life or death moment, I am alone. Mm-hmm. And Pablo, there was healing, immense healing in that moment. Jesus asked me, my 15-year-old self, where I wanted to go, because I didn't want to go home or back to the wreck. And my 15-year-old self, as I was being led through that, said the ocean. And he said, good, let's leave here after 40 years and go to the ocean together.
Wow.
And so part of what I couldn't, your question was what I would tell mm-hmm. that man that mm-hmm. I used to be. I couldn't, I don't think, have swayed him, no matter what I came back in time to say to him. Mm-hmm. But the beauty is Jesus came to rescue a part of me that was over 40 years ago, mm-hmm. 2-3 months ago. I mean, current stuff. And I have felt even more healing and yes. more release from the desire to try to control and the desire to try mm-hmm. to not, you know, I can't trust anybody, so I have to just kind of do this alone. Hmm. And so the healing continues when we're with Jesus on this journey of sonship. And I just share that. I hope it's helpful for maybe a listener or somebody out there, but he doesn't just heal our future. He actually heals our past.
Yes.
When we allow him to father us.
Yes, he does. Yes, he does. And in what I'm hearing you for me right now, Alan, and hopefully for someone out there who's listening too, when we are presented with our choices to risk the real and choose God, or to risk or to choose something else as a counterfeit, an artificial second best, if you will, that choice is highly rooted in how we see God, and how we see God is highly rooted in moments like that. You learned that day that you were on your own. And it took years to begin learning that you were not, that you actually had a loving father who was willing to walk with you and offered to you everything that your heart needed, everything that your soul needed, everything that you needed to thrive in life. And so I'm reflecting, and I'm asking Jesus to show me, as I ask Jesus to show our listeners now, if I am not all in for God, what's in the way? And when did that start?
Yes.
Along with an invitation to, would you allow Jesus to reveal to you where you came to believe that life was up to you, that you needed to make it happen on your own, that whatever it is that you long for, that your heart needs, that your soul needs, can only be found if you make it happen, right?
Right.
Where did that start? And would you invite Jesus to show you and to heal that so that you can trust him and receive from him all that he wants and all that he has to give you because he is a good father? Thank you for that, Alan. That is a treasure.
And he, God, you know, the lie that we come to embrace is, especially I think men, is, well, that's just who I am. I've always been this way.
That's my personality. That's who I am. Yeah.
Right. Or I've had to be this way. And to go, actually, no, the enemy, whether you remember it or not, I had forgotten. I knew I had been in the wreck, but I had forgotten all the agreements I made that night and that I was stuck. And the enemy will find us in our youngest, most vulnerable place that he can to insert those lies. I was never more vulnerable. I had a concussion that night on the walk home. I was bleeding with a concussion. I was abandoned. I had just lost my vehicle that I'd saved up for years, mowing yards to buy that car. I was 15, and I was never more vulnerable to embracing a lie that felt absolutely true. And as soon as I embraced it, it was erased from my mind that I had ever even embraced it. And it would play out over decades in ways that I didn't even know the root of. And so, I that's what I think is the beauty, that only God can heal these places in us. You could go, I could have gone to counseling, and I love counselors and I do counseling, but I could have gone to a counselor for 10 years and never had the breakthrough that happened in a moment when Jesus took me back to that. And so when we risk at being all in, the way God will father us, he is absolutely after our total healing. And he'll go back in time. He'll go back to when you were 6, 8, 12. And it may have been something, you know, I drank that night. I caused the wreck from doing something foolish, but the enemy used it to try to destroy my life. Like it. And, so just the beauty, Pablo, of what we can have in terms of healing, no matter what our age is, no matter how many years later, he's after us all. The wholeness of us is his whole point, is intimacy, wholeness, union. And he won't stop. You know, he'll pursue us like the father with the prodigal son.
Thank God.
Until we're back.
Thank God for that. Thank God for that. Alan, thank you. This is so rich. This is a treasure. Thank you for offering your heart. Thank you for offering who you are to me and to our listeners, to our Wildsons community. Is there anything on set? Is there anything that, as you think about who's listening to this podcast now, that you'd like to communicate either about the book, about God, about who you are?
I would just, I would encourage anyone listening to just take the step to be all in and just taste that, to not assume you're all in, because most of us have that percentage where we're not quite all in, or we don't quite understand the rage that comes, or, you know, the lust or the pull toward whatever validation. And I would just say, Pablo, my closing thought would just be, there's never a better time and a more necessary time than this world we're in right now. That's more chaotic than ever. We're in the later days of the story from creation to now. We've never been closer to the end of that part of the story, I believe. And it's not a time to dabble. It's not a time to try to do a little bit of God and a little bit of whatever else. So just to ask God, God, Father, I want to be all in I want to be healed in the places I've never been healed in yet, that I've never brought to you yet, that I don't understand yet. And I want to risk that for the real me that you created. And so that I can be fully present in such a time as this for my family, for the people who need to hear and see my strength, kingdom strength. So yeah, that's my prayer for everyone listening, is just let go of whatever's in the way, burn the last boat, get rid of the last backup plan, and just be all in. And when you are, there's a lot of freedom knowing your knee won't bow to anything, and that you're fully in with God as his son in this story. So that's my prayer for everyone listening. Just try it. Don't rationalize. Don't wait. Say yes today.
Come on. The safest place this late in the battle is with Jesus and Jesus alone.
It's the only safe place. Yeah.
Thank you, Alan. How do we find more about Alan Arnold, your books?
Yeah, the books you can buy on Amazon, and Risk the Real is the newest. I'd love for you to dive in there. One of the things, if you're not watching this, if you're listening, the book is a 6x6 square format with each chapter like 3 pages with a quote in between chapters. And the whole goal was, how do you enter into this idea a few pages at a time in a kind way to your heart, knowing that we all have full days and a lot pulling on us? So yeah, I think this is the kind of book that you can read a few pages at a time, but that will take you into deeper waters at a kind pace. And my other books are on Amazon as well. My website is withallen, withallen.com. And you can read some chapters and watch some videos and hear some podcasts about this message there. But I think nothing makes me happier than connecting with kindred spirits who are all in on this journey of sonship and who want to pursue their creativity together actively with God.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you so much. And I can't wait to have you again in the podcast. Hopefully this is the first of many.
I'd love that, Pablo. Thanks for inviting me on and for the conversation. It was life-giving.
It's been an honor having you. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Wild Sons podcast. And if you did, I want to invite you to subscribe to it and to share it with anyone in your world that you think could benefit from it. And also to visit us at wildsons.com to learn more about our online workshops and our weekend retreats and events, and to subscribe to Wild Sons Weekly, our free newsletter for those who want to become the men, the husbands, the fathers, the leaders God created them to be. See you next time.